idea that this autonomy is going to give the people of Sahrawi their rights. I mean, we've seen what happens when authoritarian states grant so-called autonomy to regions. We think of Ethiopia and Eritrea,
we have five
Serbia
seconds.
And Kosovo. It doesn't come out well.
Professor Stephen Zunis teaches politics at the University of San Francisco. His books include Western Sahara War, Nationalism and Conflict, Irresolution. Go to democracynow.org to see our documentary, 4 Days in Western Sahara, Africa's Last Colony. That does it for our broadcast. I'm Amy Goodman. Stay safe.
To listener-supported community radio, KBOO Portland.
This is Adam of Ethereal and E. Tune in on March 28th at 11 p.m. for Eclectic Pandemic on KBOO Portland.
Prison Pipeline is a radio program dedicated to educating the public about the Oregon criminal justice system. Topics include incarceration and reentry, addictions and mental health, elections and laws, victims' rights, and criminal justice reform. The program presents a unique understanding of the criminal justice system, addresses the root causes of crime, and challenges the status quo. It seeks to promote awareness and activism in order to foster a safer, healthier, and more just society.
Prison Pipeline airs on Monday evenings from 6:30 to 7 p.m. on KBOO Portland. Check us out every week. If you miss an episode, you can stream it later. Just go to kboo.fm/prisonpipeline. More info about upcoming shows and events related to the prison community can be found on our Facebook page, Prison Pipeline. Be sure to like us.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, today is the last day for Oregon tenants to apply for emergency rental assistance. Supreme Court confirmation hearings for nominee Ketanji Brown Jackson begin today. And in international news, Ukraine refuses Russian demands to surrender the port city of Mariupol. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Monday, March 21st, 2022. I'm Althea Billings. Today is the last day for Oregonians to apply to the state's rental assistance program after it was extended by an additional week. The U.S. Department of Treasury gave the state a late influx of $16 million of federal funding last week to keep the program open for an extra week. The Oregon Emergency Rental Assistance Program was originally scheduled to shut down on midnight, March 14th, and was extended until midnight tonight. Currently, renters in Oregon are protected from eviction due to non-payment of rent if they have proof that they're applying for rental insurance. Tenants can still be protected from eviction up until September of 2022 if they have a rental assistance application pending with any entity in the state. Oregon's emergency program has been the main source of rental assistance in the state during the pandemic, but other nonprofits and community organizations have also offered rental aid. The state's program alone has paid out $302 million in rental assistance to almost 42,000 households over the past 9 months. Oregonians can visit OregonRentalAssistance.org to complete an application or find more information. The application will close to new applicants tonight, March 21st at 11:59 p.m. Ukraine refused Russian demands on Monday to surrender the port city of Mariupol as the nearly month-long war is on the verge of entering a stalemate. Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky rejected Russia's demand to give up the city by 5 a.m. local time after Moscow promised to allow civilians trapped in the city without water, heat, or medicine to escape if its defenders laid down their arms. Seizing control of the strategic port city would represent a significant victory for Russian forces. A senior NATO intelligence official said Monday that Belarus, a close Russian ally, may soon itself attack Ukraine and is preparing to potentially let Russia position nuclear weapons on Belarusian soil. Belarus has already allowed Russia's military to use its territory to invade Ukraine. The nation has played a key role, as using its border has been strategically advantageous to Russia because Belarus's border with Ukraine is much closer to Kiev than Russia's. That provides a shorter pathway for Russian troops to reach the Ukrainian capital. However, Russia's land advance has seemingly ground to a halt, and their military campaign is shifting to intensifying aerial bombardment of Ukrainian cities. The NATO official added that despite making no significant progress in the past 2 weeks, Putin appears committed and unwilling to admit failure, likely precluding the possibility that he'll back down. According to the United Nations, at least 925 civilians have been killed and another 1,500 injured in Ukraine since Russia invaded the country nearly a month ago. The UN High Commissioner for Human Rights says the actual casualty numbers are probably much higher, especially in areas of Ukraine controlled by Russian forces. President Joe Biden will head to Europe this week, including a visit to Poland, a NATO member that borders Ukraine. This comes as his administration warned U.S. businesses on Monday to take added precautions amid intelligence that Russia could target American companies with cyber attacks. Recent polling has shown the vast majority of Americans think prescription drug prices are too high. Now, Oregonians are calling on Congress to do something about the rising costs. Eric Tegedoff has more.
Many Oregonians want Congress to act on the escalating prices of prescription drugs. More than 65,000 people from around the state have signed an AARP petition calling on lawmakers to take steps to control drug costs now. Stacy Larson with AARP Oregon says high drug prices directly impact people's lives.
We know that Americans right now are paying more than three times what people in other countries pay for the very same medicines. Many seniors here in Oregon are often forced to choose between filling a prescription or buying groceries, paying for their utilities or other necessities.
AARP is supporting legislation that would allow Medicare to negotiate prescription drug prices, put a cap on out-of-pocket costs for older Americans, and impose penalties on drug companies that raise prices faster than the rate of inflation. Last week, Oregonians delivered their petition virtually to Senators Ron Wyden and Jeff Merkley, telling stories of financial hardship and even losing their homes because of the cost of medication. The two senators have pledged their support to bring prices down. Larson says this issue cuts across party lines.
It's not a blue issue. It's not a red issue. This is an issue of universal concern, and it's touching seniors, families all over the state.
A Kaiser Family Foundation poll from 2021 found about 8 in 10 Americans think the cost of prescription drugs is unreasonable. It also topped the list of healthcare concerns people want Congress to tackle. I'm Eric Tegedoff reporting.
The U.S. Supreme Court said Monday that it would not review the case of a Seattle-based Christian organization that was sued after declining to hire a bisexual lawyer who applied for a job. A lower court had let the case go forward, and the high court said it wouldn't intervene. KBOO's Josh Salem has the story.
The Supreme Court has declined to review the case of a Seattle-based Christian organization that was sued after it refused to hire a bisexual lawyer. A lower court allowed the case to proceed, but the higher court said today it would not intervene. The case involves Seattle's Union Gospel Mission. That organization offers addiction recovery and job placement and legal services, and it provides food and shelter to the houseless. In 2016, it was looking for an attorney to help staff its legal aid clinic. Matthew Woods, a volunteer at the clinic for more than 3 years, applied. Woods identifies as bisexual and was in a same-sex relationship. He was told before he applied that his application would be rejected because the organization's code of conduct excludes homosexual activity. Woods sued, arguing the mission violated state law by discriminating against him on the basis of his sexual orientation. A state trial court judge ruled for Seattle's Union Gospel Mission and dismissed Woods' lawsuit. The judge ruled that the organization is exempt from the state's anti-discrimination law. However, the Washington Supreme Court reversed the decision and let the lawsuit go forward. The Supreme Court already has a dispute involving businesses citing religious reasons to deny goods or services and LGBTQ plus rights on its docket. It will hear arguments this fall in a case involving a Colorado web designer who says her religious beliefs prevent her from offering wedding website designs to gay couples. Justices Samuel Alito and Clarence Thomas said that, quote, "the day may soon come," end quote, when the court needs to confront the issue the union hiring case presents. For KBOO News, I'm Josh Salem.
Non-disclosure agreements barring workers from speaking up about workplace violations have been on the rise. As Eric Tegedoff reports, a new law in Washington state bans these type of provisions.
A new law in Washington state bans employers from silencing employees about illegal acts in the workplace. The Silenced No More Act, which passed in the 2022 session, allows workers to file lawsuits for discrimination, harassment, retaliation, and wage and hour violations. It prohibits and nullifies non-disclosure agreements, or NDAs, on these issues, which the state already prohibited in sexual harassment cases. Kelly Carson with the Washington State Association for Justice says non-disclosure clauses covering workplace violations are on the rise in contracts people sign at the start of a job.
The original use of non-disclosure agreements was to protect trade secrets, and that still is in place. Nothing in this bill affects that, so that's still allowed. But in recent years, they've been increasing incredibly as a condition of employment.
California has passed a similar law. In Congress earlier this year, a bipartisan effort pushed legislation across the finish line to make it easier for workers to sue employers in cases of sexual harassment. State Representative Liz Berry of Seattle was a sponsor of the bill. She says these types of provisions are mostly used by big tech companies.
Despite the progress we've made in recent years, too many workers are still forced to sign NDAs and settle in agreements that silence them. This bill will allow all survivors of inappropriate or illegal workplace misconduct to share their experiences if they choose to do so.
Carson says this law strengthens workers' rights.
For a long time, people were always afraid of retaliation. People didn't want to speak up, and they just wanted to keep their head down and keep their job. And with the Me Too movement, people, I think, are starting to feel a little bit more empowered to say, I don't have to put up with unlawful conduct at work.
The bill currently is awaiting the governor's signature. For Washington News Service, I'm Eric Tegedoff.
Judge Ketanji Brown Jackson, President Joe Biden's pick for the Supreme Court, went before the Democratic-led Judiciary Committee on Monday. Jackson is hoping to replace retiring Justice Stephen Breyer as the first black woman to serve on the Supreme Court. Jackson has already made history as the first black woman ever nominated to serve on the nation's highest court. Monday featured opening remarks by the chair and members of the Judiciary Committee, followed by remarks from Jackson. Judiciary Committee Chair Dick Durbin, a Democrat from Illinois, said that Jackson has already been confirmed by the Senate to other positions three times, twice with no opposition, to the U.S. Sentencing Commission, the Federal District Court for D.C., and last year to the Appeals Court. Durbin says he wants the full Senate to confirm Jackson by April 9th. Jackson said on Monday, quote, "I have been a judge for nearly a decade now, and I take that responsibility and my duty to be independent very seriously. I decide cases from a neutral posture. I evaluate the facts, and I interpret and apply the law to the facts of the case before me without fear or favor, consistent with my judicial oath." According to a new report from Research and Advocacy Center at the Sentencing Project, almost 250,000 kids in the U.S. were incarcerated in 2019. Suzanne Potter has more.
Almost a quarter million American children were incarcerated in 2019, according to a new report called Too Many Closed Doors from the Sentencing Project. That number is about five times more than the annual point-in-time counts reveal. Report author Josh Rovner says we've been looking at the wrong numbers.
As of one day in 2019, there were about 36,000 kids who were in youth facilities, and the actual number of kids who were in the facilities over the course of the year closer to 240,000, and that is actually an undercount.
The report found that the kids are overwhelmingly being detained for low-level offenses and that the disruption to their schooling and home life actually makes them more likely to be rearrested in the future. In addition, the detention rates are much higher in poverty-stricken communities of color where there is more police presence. Rovner says that leads to big racial disparities.
Overall, one out of every four kids who are sent to court are detained at the outset. Now, for white youth, that's 1 out of every 5. For Black and Latino youth, it's closer to 30%, and that is not connected to the seriousness of the offense.
Daniel McAleer with the Center on Juvenile and Criminal Justice in San Francisco says youth crime has dropped dramatically in the past 30 years. California once detained about 10,000 kids. Now it's down to about 3,000. He notes that the state overbuilt juvenile detention centers in the 90s and now has 12,000 beds. He thinks that creates an incentive to use them.
I think it's partly just a matter of bureaucratic convenience and the concern over, well, we built these detention beds, and if we don't keep them filled, what implications will that have for the department's budget, employment? The unions get upset. And so there's a whole lot of factors that are weighing in here.
California will close the last of its state youth detention facilities by next summer. Juvenile justice will be handled entirely at the county level, so kids who are detained can be closer to family and be connected with local programs to help them rebuild their lives. This is Suzanne Potter reporting.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for a special encore broadcast of our interview with folks from the Environmental Integrity Project talking about their new report that shows that the Clean Water Act falls short of its full promise 50 years later. At 6, stick around for Labor Radio. At 6:30, it's Prison Pipeline. Then at 7, Hard Knock Radio. Tonight's weather will be cloudy with scattered showers and a low of 49 degrees. Tomorrow will be partly cloudy with a high of 67. Today in history, in 1965, 3,200 civil rights demonstrators in Alabama, led by Martin Luther King Jr., began a historic march from Selma to Montgomery, the state's capital. Federalized Alabama National Guardsmen and FBI agents were on hand to provide safe passage for the march, which twice had been turned back by Alabama State Police at Selma's Edmund Pettus Bridge, where several protesters had been severely beaten by Alabama State Troopers. The quote of the day is from King, which he wrote while incarcerated in Birmingham Jail. He wrote, quote, "Shallow understanding from people of goodwill is more frustrating than absolute misunderstanding from people of ill will." Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky pleads for assistance from Israel, and confirmation hearings begin for Biden's Supreme Court pick Ketanji Brown Jackson. With more on those stories, it's Mary Sherman with 2022 Talks.
Welcome to 2022 Talks, where we're following our democracy in historic times.
What will be left of our cities in Ukraine after this terrible war?
With advances by the Russian military driving up casualties, Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky addressed the Israeli parliament Sunday. Speaking through a translator, Zelensky questioned Israel's reluctance to sell its Iron Dome missile defense system to his nation.
The Ukrainians have made their choice 8 years ago. We saved Jews, and this is why the Israeli people now need to choose to make a similar decision.
Zelensky said he's ready to negotiate with Russian President Vladimir Putin, but cautioned that failed attempts at a truce between the countries could lead to a third world war. U.S. officials warn Russian steps that would limit travel by some civilians there could evolve into what amounts to concentration camps. As the first and only Ukrainian-American in Congress, Representative Victoria Spartz of Indiana argues that the U.S. and its allies have a responsibility to help.
Ukrainians fight in this war for all of us, for the peace in the world, for world order, and really, you know, their bastion right now of freedoms that they're on the front line.
President Joe Biden is expected to rally support for Ukraine when he meets with NATO this week in Belgium. The Securities and Exchange Commission is expected to propose new rules today that would require companies to disclose their contributions to greenhouse gas emissions. Many companies already acknowledge the impact of climate change, but some fear such mandates could leave them open to liability lawsuits. Confirmation hearings begin today for Supreme Court nominee Ketanji Brown Jackson, who could become the first Black woman to sit on the nation's highest court. Senate Judiciary Chair Dick Durbin will preside over the hearings.
Just as impressive as Judge Jackson's record is her character and temperament. Humble, personable. She's dedicated herself to making our legal system more understandable and more accessible.
Durbin is also pushing back against accusations that Judge Jackson has been lenient on sentencing sex offenders, claiming the allegations are not credible. In election news, the New York Times found that under a restrictive new law, 18,000 Texas voters had mail-in ballots rejected during this month's primary. The Times found the rejections were most common in Black neighborhoods. Missouri's election maps aren't ready. They've been delayed by redistricting battles, and the filing deadline for candidates is a week from tomorrow. Cape Girardeau County Election Supervisor Alan Seaball says right now, voters and candidates might not even know what district they're in.
We want to get changes made to our voter registration system so that all voters are assigned to the correct district so that whenever they go to vote on August 2nd, we know which ballot to give them in correlation to where they live.
Funeral arrangements haven't been announced for Alaska Congressman Don Young, who passed away late Friday. The 88-year-old Republican was the longest-serving member of Congress and was a strong advocate for the Trans-Alaska Pipeline. I'm Mary Sherman for Pacifica Network and Public News Service. Find our 8 trust indicators to support transparency and accuracy at publicnewsservice.org.
The top First Nations leader in Manitoba, Canada, is facing allegations of sexual assault, and Native organizations in the U.S. reflect on the work of Alaska Representative Don Young, who passed away on Friday. With those stories and more, it's Antonia Gonzalez with National Native News.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. The top First Nations leader in Manitoba, Canada, is facing allegations of sexual assault. As Dan Karpinchuk reports, he's now off the job, pending an investigation.
It's not the first time that Arlen Dumas has faced this kind of allegation. Dumas is the Grand Chief of the Assembly of Manitoba Chiefs. The allegation of harassment and sexual assault against him was made by a senior staff member who wrote to the AMC's Executive Council. The member says this letter also serves to bring immediate attention to breaches of code of conduct of the AMC Constitution. Based on my personal experiences of sexual harassment, and sexualized violence by Grand Chief Arlen Dumas. The staff member then says the harassment from Dumas began on the second day of employment by phone, in person, and virtually. Advocate Hilda Anderson Pierce is the chair of the National Family and Survivor Circle. She says the incident has prompted her to reach out to any other victims of this kind of violence.
The experience of violence and the trauma and the fear of publicly disclosing your experience, you know, it's a very difficult journey to be on.
The Assembly of Manitoba Chiefs will appoint an acting Grand Chief today and will also review existing workplace harassment policies. For National Native News, I'm Dan Karpinchuk.
Leaders of Native organizations and tribes across the country are reflecting on the work of U.S. Representative Don Young. Alaska's only congressman, a Republican, died Friday at age 88. In a statement, the Alaska Federation of Natives said achievements he championed on behalf of Alaska Natives will not be forgotten. AFN President Julie Kitka said, "We did not always agree. However, he was always willing to listen, and if he could help, he would." In a recent hearing on tribal co-management of federal lands in the House Natural Resources Committee, Young advocated for Alaska tribes, saying Alaska Natives should be partners in managing parks.
Parks and partners. That's what I want. Parks and partners together. And you'll find out your job's going to be a whole lot easier if you have partners. And the partners should be those that originally lived there prior to the creation of the parks. And let them have the opportunity for jobs and opportunity to present their point of view.
The National Congress of American Indians in a statement said Representative Young worked with Alaska Native and American Indian leaders to help protect lands, people, natural resources, subsistence rights, and tribal economies. NCAI Alaska Region Vice President Mike Williams said Congressman Young helped achieve a great deal of success for American Indians and Alaska Natives, putting aside any difference for the betterment of our people. Young, who was elected to Congress in 1973, died while traveling home to Alaska. His office is expected to release more details and plans for a celebration of his life. A documentary telling the stories of three Native women involving missing and murdered relatives premieres Monday night on Twin Cities PBS.
Her body was found wrapped in trash bags in the Red River.
She was kidnapped and raped. She was meant to be trafficked.
people have gone missing since European settlers set land here on Turtle Island.
Bring Her Home tells the story of Indigenous women advocates. An activist, an artist, and a politician seek healing and hope as they draw attention to the issue of missing and murdered Indigenous people. The film is directed and produced by Leah Hale, Sisseton Wahpeton Dakota, and Dene. She hopes the film will drive public awareness and serve as a catalyst for conversation, cultural reclamation, and change. The film is also available for online streaming. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
The abundance of kelp forests in the Puget Sound has fallen off greatly, with consequences for species such as salmon and orca. Eric Tegadoff has more.
Kelp forests in Puget Sound play an integral role environmentally and culturally, but they're in steep decline. There are more than 20 species of kelp in the region that are a vital source of food and habitat for marine animals. They also are important to Indigenous people of the region. Todd Woodard, Natural Resources Director for the Samish Indian Nation, says tribal members have used kelp fronds as wraps to cook salmon and kelp bulbs to carry oil for heat and light and as rattles for young children.
It's a critical part of cultural identity to the Coast Salish people here. It's a critical part of the sense of place that Indigenous populations have. And Indigenous people, both on the First Nations and the tribe side, are working very hard to try and figure out what's happening and what can be done to mitigate for it.
Last summer, Puget Sound Restoration Fund brought together 200 people for an 8-day scientific exploration of kelp. It's part of an effort to implement the 2020 Puget Sound Kelp Conservation and Recovery Plan. The team is releasing videos of its expedition to raise awareness about kelp's decline. Betsy Peabody is executive director of the Puget Sound Restoration Fund. She says kelp is vital to the food web, which means they support iconic Northwest species such as salmon and orca. Peabody notes humans rely on Puget Sound's food web as well, and so the decline of kelp forests has a direct impact on people.
We're just wanting to work with others to really connect those dots in the way that we need to in order to support the conservation and restoration at a scale that can help protect these essential, iconic marine systems.
Peabody says warming temperatures are putting pressure on kelp, but the species also plays an essential role capturing climate warming sources of carbon.
Underwater kelp forests provide some of the same CO2 sequestration that terrestrial forests provide.
Support for this reporting was provided by the Pew Charitable Trust. For Washington News Service, I'm Eric Tegadoff.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News for Monday, March 21st, 2022. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news, stories, and tips at 971-245-2158. Our remote production team for tonight's newscast includes Josh Salem, the producer is Yasmin Kobanoglu, and our engineer is Otto. Special thanks to Antonia Gonzalez, Suzanne Potter, Mary Sherman, and Eric Tegadoff. The director of Evening News is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282 BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220 HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Althea Billings. Coming up tomorrow morning on KBOO, at 8, it's Too Much Information with Abe and Tracy, covering politics and current events while taking listener calls. At 9, it's Alternative Radio, featuring lectures and interviews with progressive thinkers. At 10, it's Flashpoints, investigative news radio with host Dennis Bernstein. At 11, we'll hear Times Like Now with Trevor Collins. Then at 11:30, it's Art Focus. Host Joseph Gallivan interviews photographer Diago Diaz about his show, Vineyard Photography, on Now at Syndicate. All of these KBOO programs, including the evening news, are made possible by support from our members. If you'd like to become a member and support our programming, you can go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321. Stay tuned now for a special encore broadcast of our coverage of the Environmental Integrity Project's report on the Clean Water Act, which shows that 50 years later, only half of its promises have been fully kept. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
KBOO News In Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
You're listening to KBOO News In Depth. I'm Althea Billings. It's been 50 years since the landmark environmental law, the Clean Water Act, was passed in 1972. It was an ambitious piece of legislation, and it made a real difference in some of the most polluted rivers and waterways in the U.S. But a new report from the Environmental Integrity Project shows that half a century later, the promises of the Clean Water Act have only been half kept. Their research ranked Oregon as number two in the U.S. for the most miles of rivers and waterways that aren't safe for swimming and other kinds of recreation. I spoke with Eric Schaefer, one of the report's co-authors, to learn more about their findings. So yeah, thanks for taking the time to speak with me today. The Environmental Integrity Project has just released this report that shows that about half of the rivers, lakes, and reservoirs in the United States are still not safe for swimming, fishing, and recreation, which is, of course, contrary to what the Clean Water Act of 1972 would have provided. And that's definitely a big problem. To start out, for folks who may be unfamiliar, what did the Clean Water Act put into law back when it was first passed?
We were supposed to get fishable, swimmable water by 1983. And the law also set a goal of stopping the discharge of all pollutants into navigable waterways by 1985. We used to dream big back in those days. You know, obviously those were very ambitious goals. It turned out to be more ambitious than I think people realized at the time. But